You are listening to the Underdog Way podcast with me, Ruben Pillai, where I interview amazing guests who face adversity, overcome challenges, and found their purpose. We share stories to inspire change. Remember, your change will begin when you turn inspiration into action. This episode is brought to you in partnership with the Stop Holding Back Foundation, a charity really close to my heart that is focused on the personal development of people who stutter. A big shout out to everyone part of the SHB family. I love you all and thank you for the support. Every corner twice as bright, there'll be my treasures forever. When I can't hold you tight, I'll see the Stockholm lights. The Stockholm lights, the Stockholm lights. Today's guest is aspiring journalist turned comedian Glenn Moore, who has performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and has been nominated for the prestigious Edinburgh Comedy Award. Glenn talks about his journey, which took him all the way to national TV, where he has made appearances on BBC show Mock the Week. Glenn talks about the fears and challenges that he's encountered in his career. And this interview is a really fascinating insight into the life of a comedian. Without further ado, Glenn Moore. I will be interviewing Glenn about his journey over the past 13 years since 2007.
Horrible when we put it like that. 13 years.
Yeah. Time does fly.
You're so old. I know. I properly started comedy in like sort of like 2012 or so, but I'd had the idea to maybe try to attempt to go into it a couple of years earlier. But certainly when we were at school, it was never a career or anything like that, or even a hobby that I'd ever considered, like at all. And I don't really remember trying to make people laugh at school or anything like that. And I don't think anyone who we went to school with would remember me for doing that, or would remember me full stop. I think you were quite
funny though.
Thanks, man.
But I think you were, because I remember in GCSE English when we had this exercise to do, and it was the one where you had to BS.
Oh my God, with Adnan?
Yes.
I spoke about this on a podcast about 3 weeks ago, yeah. And I remember it so vividly. It was me and Adnan Ahmed. We had to interview Robert Louis Stevenson.
Yeah.
And so I was playing Michael Parkinson. He was playing Robert Louis Stevenson. And I mean, Adnan was really the key player there. He was just absolutely hilarious. And my job was just to try and keep a straight face through everything he was saying, because he was just so ridiculous. But that I probably think may have been quite a formative experience in terms of making me want to go into it, because it was like just hearing a classroom of people who, some of whom you're really good friends with and some of whom you never talk to at all.
Yeah.
Laughing at something you've like co-written with someone was just the best feeling.
Actual
full-time comedy now does not compare to that moment in that tiny classroom with Miss Carroll.
Yeah. I think as well, in terms of like the judgment around the classroom and all the cliques of different people and it's harder in boys' school as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
To actually stand out as
Exactly. And you know with certain cliques as well that there's certain things that if you say something that you think is funny, there are going to be people who are approaching it with their arms already folded. They are determined not to like anything you say. And that's weird. I think we were quite privileged, I guess, to have a really overall quite friendly school environment. And there wasn't really anyone who was just like permanently awful or anyone, you know.
Yeah.
And I kind of enjoyed flitting around sort of like various social groups and stuff like that, but there was still like I'd say in a year group of like 150 people, I'd say overall there's maybe like 15 or 20 people I will never ever talk to that person. They are going to hate me. I do not stand a chance if I try and converse with them even for a second.
We can name them afterwards, don't worry.
We'll do a list, basically the opposite of a shout out. Yeah,
brilliant. This was in 2007 at the end of school. Then
We left school, and 2012, you said, that's when you started to flirt with the idea of...
Yeah, kind of, as in, like, I was, so I went to uni, I was at the University of Sheffield, and I remember in, like, 2009, 2010, so, like, my sort of second year, third year of uni, there wasn't any stand-up or anything like that, but there was, like, an improv comedy group, and I was so interested, because I watched a couple of their shows, and just watching an audience just absolutely losing their minds at how funny they found this show, because it was all made up on the spot. And I was watching it just like, I can't believe how good this is. And I remember the University of Sheffield had this student comedy festival where you had like, certainly from a student perspective, the big student comedy names, which was like, you know, the Cambridge Footlights were like the main one. And so they like headlined the first night. And I remember sitting in this auditorium of like 400, 500 people, and just, I couldn't believe that people my age or a year older could be that funny. It just blew my mind. And so many of them now have gone on to forge like great comedy careers. Among them was a guy called Liam Williams, who made the BBC sitcom Please Like. He's excellent. Okay. I remember him vividly. I remember the entirety of his stand-up set and just being like, I just saw comedians as being in like, I mean, you get someone like Kevin Bridges or Jack White who start really young, but generally from growing up, I just got used to people like Lee Evans and stuff like that, people who were in their 30s and 40s. And so then researching comedy afterwards and looking into it more and seeing someone like Eddie Murphy doing stadium gigs when he was like 18 or something like that. It was just crazy. Yeah. And but I remember feeling intimidated by that and thinking even if I tried, I would never be as good as them. It made me want to try like improvised comedy. And I think that's the most nervous I'd ever felt when you had to sort of go to these different like classes kind of, because it was this university society. And once they thought you were good enough, you were then put in like this extra sort of level. And then if you were good enough from there, you got to then do like your first proper performance with the group. And I remember just, that's the most nervous I think I've ever been before a gig ever. And I was just going to the show because I think it is scary sometimes doing stand up and just being like, what if people don't laugh, and you reach a certain level where like you learn how to die on stage, you learn how to deal with doing badly. And there was one year I was at the Edinburgh Fringe, this is zooming ahead a bit, but in 2014 I was doing this sort of showcase show at the Edinburgh Fringe for the whole month, where it was a show, it was me and two other comics doing 20 minutes of stand-up each, and I really only had like 20 minutes of material, and walked out the first night. But if you go to a comedy club, that's like the length of each person's set. Mm-hmm. And if people don't like you, that drags. That really, really drags. And the increments you learn to do stand-up in is you start off with 5 minutes, between 5 and 7 minutes. And then you start to do like, you do that at like open mic nights. And then you try and enter like stand-up comedy competitions, which I think from a mental health perspective are quite unhealthy, I think, to pit other... aspiring comedians against each other and try and work out who the winner is amongst them. But it's always good if you reach like, they always have like a first round, second round, you know, quarterfinals, all that sort of stuff. And if you reach the final of one of those national competitions, then it doesn't matter if you do badly on, it doesn't matter if you don't win, because in the audience are a bunch of like agents and important people who might sign you up and they might sort of help your career. And then once you've got like a good 7 minutes, then you work up to 10 minutes and then to 20. And once you've got a good 20 minutes, like a really bulletproof 20 minutes, then you can play any comedy club in the country. And you could technically just keep doing that 20 minutes of material every night for the rest of your life. But I had 20 minutes and it was not working in Edinburgh. Okay. Every single night I was going and the other two guys were smashing it out the park. The audience loved them. And I'd come on halfway through and just, it would be pin drop silence. They hated the look of me. They hated everything about me. And it was agonizing. But after a while, I stopped being nervous about it because it was like, well, audiences don't boo these days. It's so very rare. I've never ever seen anyone get booed off. I know about three comedians who have ever been booed off, and it just isn't a thing. People are just more polite these days anyway, but you can just get complete silence. And after about a week of that, I started to just walk out on stage and just be like, well, I'm just going to say my 20, I'm going to talk for 20 minutes, do my jokes. And I've learned to not care if they don't react. And so,
do you think that's worse than booing? If it's completely
no,
silent.
booing would be worse, I think, because like mainly because I've never experienced it, and that's not me trying to be arrogant. Like, well, I've actually never been booed off, but like, well, that's quite a low bar. But like, I'd feel really scared if I got booed. I just wouldn't know how to react. I mean, I've been like heckled three times ever, and like two of the heckles were quite nice anyway. But okay. like, it's like that throws you, because you know, with complete silence, you just pretend you're in it. What I do is I just look over the top of my glasses so I can't actually see anything, and that way Clever. You just feel like you're doing it in an empty room, and it doesn't matter. But I found improvised comedy even scarier, because I was going up on stage like, I haven't got anything. I've got, you know, if I can't think of anything to say, then there'll just be silence. There's nothing to fall back on. But it was really good. It was really good fun. And I found that the laughs were easier to get, because the audience don't have a lower standard, but they're impressed at the idea of, wow, this joke has come off the top of your head, and it makes it more powerful. And so that really got in. Suddenly I was like, oh my God, I want this feeling. I want to feel this feeling like every night. This is a feeling I want to achieve whenever I can. And it really, really got me into the idea. But I still just didn't entertain the prospect that it could ever become a career, or that you could ever get paid for it or anything like that. And I almost took weird pleasure from people. If my friends at uni were ever like, oh, after uni, presumably you're going to go into stand-up, I almost kind of enjoyed saying no, like, yeah. and disappointing them and just going, no, you can't. I don't know how you do it, but I wouldn't know what to do. And I then entered this stand-up comedy competition, which is like specifically for students. And I remember getting to the final of that and thinking, because by this time I'd done like two stand-up gigs or so, I had like 5 minutes of material, which looking back was appalling. And the worst thing is, my first ever gig is on YouTube and I can't get it taken down. But it's just there forever. It was like, do you know what? For a first ever gig, I'm like, I'm proud of that. But at the same time, looking back in it now, I'd never do any of that material again. It's awful. But I remember getting to the final of this competition, and I made this rule for myself. I was like, if I win, I'll try and go into comedy full time, and I'll probably give it a go. And if I don't win, then I will just go into journalism and news reading, which is what I was going to go into anyway. And I came second, and it was like, oof. Oh, that's tricky. What do I do? Yeah. That's kind of close. So, and I remember like an agent getting in touch with me afterwards, and he was sort of like, he told me about a couple of like quite big names he met, like arena filling comics that he sort of managed. And he was like, do you want to chat, meet up in London and have a chat about me potentially being your agent? And I was like, oh my God, it felt like something out of a movie. I just couldn't believe that the process was this quick. This was like my third ever stand-up gig. And I definitely knew I wasn't good enough to have an agent or anything like that. And so I went down to London, and he was like, yeah, you know, this, I'd be willing to represent you if you want to have an agent. And I was like, yeah. But he said, you've got to move to London. And by this point, I lived in Sheffield, because I'd stayed on for a year after uni, and I'd done a master's, and I just got a job working at a radio station as like a very serious like news reporter. And I sort of said, I can't just yet, because I've just got this new job, and I'd love to be a comedian, but I feel like I've spent my entire university education like trying to become a journalist, and now I've got that first journalism job, and it feels weird to sort of, it would be weird to throw that away for a career that I don't even think I'm good at yet, because I've only done three gigs. And he was like, well, no worries, leave it a year. And, you know, leave it for a year. And then in a year's time, maybe move to London in a year, and we'll talk then. And I was like, okay, and you're definitely not going to forget me. And he was like, I definitely won't forget you. And a year after being a journalist, I quit and I moved down to London. And about 2 days after I moved to London, I rang him up, and I was like, I was so excited to ring him. And I said, hi, it's Glenn. And he went, Glenn. And I went, yeah, Glenn Moore.
Oh, no.
God. And it was like, oh, he has actually forgotten me. And eventually, right, I sort of jogged his memory, and he was like, I'm so sorry, man. He said, in the last year, I've signed a lot of new clients. I just don't have any space anymore. And I was just sat there just like, I wish I'd rung him before I quit my job.
I was just about to say that, city.
It was so dumb, but I think I was just like, I think because I was scared. I was scared if I did that in Sheffield, then I would never leave Sheffield. And I could have had a, you know, I would have happily lived in Sheffield for the rest of my life. I loved it there, but I'd been told by him specifically, you need to move to London, which just isn't true. But I was just like, that was the first major like setback, because it was just like, what the hell do I do now? And I was just doing like any temp job I could during the week, and doing any open mic gig at night where it's just you and 20 other acts doing like 4 minutes each, and there's three people in the audience, because why would anyone else be there? Who wants to see 20 brand new comics do 3 minutes of material? And it was, I was just like, this has been a complete error. And I remember feeling really embarrassed about that as a decision. And like every time I like ran my parents and I'm like, how's everything going in London? I would just like lie through my teeth and be like, it's great. But in reality, I was like, yeah, what do you do? There's no, like, comedy doesn't have a curriculum. There's no natural sort of progression, and you don't apply for jobs. You don't have a CV or anything like that. It was just crazily scary. And like, yeah, crazy.
In terms of the process then, for the next step, did you take part again in the big events? And
I almost sort of started from scratch again, and I was still new enough that I could still enter a few of those like new act competitions. And I did one in Edinburgh called Say You Think You're Funny, and it's a competition that's got this history of like every year they have like 10 finalists, and if you look through the Wikipedia entry, every year you can pick out 5 people at least who then went on to become massive household names. It's always like Peter Kay or Lee Evans, people like, it's just every year there was someone massive. And so I was like, I want to get to, I got to the final of that, and died so hard at the final. That was like maybe the second or third time I performed to nearly complete silence. And I remember being really, really scared because I knew there was like a panel of judges, and Ruby Wax was the guest judge
for some reason.
Yeah. And, but I was glad I got to the final, cause I was like, that's fine. And that's all that matters. If there's important people in the audience, they'll see me. And, Ashlyn B ended up winning deservedly, cause she was fucking incredible. Even from like fifth gig onwards, she was just amazing. I remember I remember thinking afterwards, I was like, I got to the final. That's my career set. I don't know how it's going to work, but it will work out. And I'm being really excited. And the next day there was this scathing review online that absolutely tore apart every single one of the acts. I think apart from Ashlyn, because she'd absolutely just taken the roof off. But I remember thinking like, oh no, this is bad. And it was just, I was just so beset with doubt every single step of the way. For every great gig, there was just there'd be one that would just bring you crashing back down. And I always felt the ones I did best at were the gigs that never ended up being important. They, you know, I'd travel with a bunch of comedians who I'd never met. We'd all arrange to meet in a part of London, get in someone's car with a bunch of strangers, and we drive for 5 hours down to Devon and perform for like 5 minutes each. And then we'd get back in the car, and I'd get back to London at 4 a.m. and be up about 3 hours later to do another temp job. And it was every single day of the week. And I found it was always the ones where it was like, every time I did a gig in a tiny town where it was like that tree falling in the forest thing. It was like, this gig ultimately didn't matter. You entertained a room full of people, but they're not going to help your career, and you didn't get paid or anything like that. Those were always the ones that went best. And every time it was like, oh, I know there's someone important in the audience. It was just bad luck. Something would happen. Like, you go on stage, you're halfway through your first joke, and someone accidentally drops a pint glass at the back of the room, and the rest of the audience will turn around to look at what happened, and they miss your punchline and turn back around to be like, where's your jokes, mate? And it was moments of like sheer bad luck. Inexplicably, after that So You Think You're Funny final, where I did really badly, I got an email from an agent, again, just completely out of the blue. And she sort of said, do you want to meet up? And she said, I needed to live in London and all that sort of stuff. And so she ended up representing me. And from then on, just she used to get me to be like a stand-in at comedy clubs. So because comedy clubs are dotted all around the country and comedians travel far and wide to get to them, I used to get the megabus up to Newcastle like every Saturday.
They're really cheap as, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you'd be barely making a loss. Yeah. What inevitably happens is comedians always drop out on the night of gigs. They can't make it. The car's broken down. So, this agent who I originally had, she was good friends with all the big sort of club owners. And so she would just say to them, Glenn will fill in for you if ever you have a dropout. So every Saturday I'd be really nervous because I'd just be sat at home. And then it would get to like 5 p.m. and I'd suddenly get a text being like, you're on in Birmingham in 3 hours. And it was like, oh my God. And I'd have to like run to the nearest train station, quickly get to Birmingham and be like, what? I don't even know what kind of club is this. Is it going to be like full of stag do's and hen parties? Is it going to be rowdy? And you'd sort of barely, you know, survive the sort of 20 minutes. But then I'd be sort of on the megabus back home afterwards being like, oh my God, I got paid. I actually got my expenses paid tonight. I don't think I made a loss. I want to do this forever. This is incredible. But it's a weird career where it's almost in like a sporting sort of way where like it doesn't matter how great a good gig goes. Like, one bad one absolutely brings you crashing back down, even to the point where now you just go, have I gone into the right job? Do you know, have I always been this bad? Have I ever had a good gig? You know, even if you have like a really tightly written comedy club set, those moments where the audience just don't go for it and they just don't get you, they don't like the look of you, or they loved the previous person so much, they're angry to see someone replace them. You find yourself on stage just performing, you know, to complete silence. You just start to think to yourself, when's the next joke? I'm racking my brain, and I don't think I've got any. Have I ever written a joke? What? I mean, you start to think you're a complete fraud, and it's just a nightmare. But as soon as you get on, you know, as soon as you get on the train back home, you just forget it because you've got another gig the next night. But in those moments, it's horrible, because you're rethinking your entire career in front of an audience of drunk people. It's just that's when it becomes like what the average member of a public's worst nightmare would be. Like, anyone's fear of public speaking is that.
It's that doubt, isn't it? And I guess the feedback and the crowd and the wrong vibe, it kind of increases their tension and the messages in mind. Because I've had similar kind of experiences, like with speaking, like on stage or to groups of people, and like stuttering, like got blocks and freezes, and you think, this person's smirking, and are they thinking I'm stupid, or are they thinking this and that? And because of those thoughts, they kind of weigh up on you.
Yeah. Did you find with you, when that happens, did that make the next word seem so much further away?
Oh, like,
Did that make stuttering work? Definitely. Right. Okay. God, that must be, I can't imagine.
That's how I visualize as well, because you can kind of picture like the sentence, but the next word and the next sound.
Yeah.
And then you get there and then you start again at some point. So, but it's common among people who speaking public and facing judgment.
Yeah.
It's a common feeling.
And it's weird, because you know that the average person isn't judging. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've all been in an audience where we've seen someone struggle on stage with something, and it's you never sat there going, who the fuck is this? Yeah. Get off stage. Like, that's never going through your mind. But you imagine, you then in your head make every single audience member the most unreasonable person in the world ever. And you just think they're sat there furious, or that they can't wait to, you know, humiliate you or something like that. I hate that the human mind is naturally made up like that. Yeah. It's so annoying. It just holds you back so much. And a million great moments in front of an audience doesn't outweigh one bad one. It's ridiculous that those are on an equal plinth.
Yeah, definitely. And the good thing is kind of that you had your gig and then the next one, and it kind of helps to put the bad ones behind you.
Yeah, there's this rule that I think Sarah Millican has, where she said when she was starting out, if she had a bad gig, she'd let herself feel rubbish about it until like midday the next day. And then from midday, you got to forget about it, move on to the next gig. But also, she made sure she did that whenever she had a good gig. If she had a good gig, she'd let herself feel great about it until like midday the next day. Then nope, forget it, move on to the next one. And I think the biggest mistake I made the first time I ever had a properly bad gig was I didn't have another one in the diary. And I remember for like 3 months afterwards, wallowing in that every day, just 3 months after, it's just like, I am the worst comedian ever. This is a disaster. And I learned that actually, I don't mind. Like, I've probably, some of my worst gigs have been on, say, a Saturday night where I've had like three gigs in a row, and you got, right, I've got one in Camden, one in Piccadilly Circus, and then I've got one in Brixton afterwards, and they all happen over the course of like 3 hours. And the first one could be the worst gig I've ever had, but while I'm on stage, all I'm really thinking about is, right, if I can make the tube in 10 minutes, I should be fine to get on stage for a second one. And you just forget about it, because you go, it's a bit, life will completely reset in 20 minutes time, because I'll be performing in front of a completely different audience who have no idea what just happened to me. So that's fine. And so it's almost forcing yourself to confront that fear all the time. Because of COVID-19, obviously, I haven't done any live gigs, and I know I'm going to be so, so nervous in a way I haven't felt in ages, that when it comes to doing a live gig again, because by that point, it will have been like, what, 9 months since the last one? And I remember the last gig I did was on a Saturday. It was about a week before lockdown started, and I had 5 gigs. The first one, it was in like late afternoon, and then they carried on all the way up until I did one that was about like 11 p.m. And I couldn't have felt more confident for those 5 gigs because it was just doing one after the other, and I can't remember how they went. I think they went fine. But I'm going to feel the complete opposite of that the first time I go back to doing a gig again, because it'll be like, I've completely forgotten what it's like to stand up in front of a room full of people and look at the front row and let's hope the first line goes well. And how am I holding the microphone? Okay. I'm not talking too low into it. Am I, that sort of thing? That sort of stuff keeps resetting. You just gonna keep forcing yourself to throw yourself back into it again and again and again. But that's just perseverance in a nutshell, isn't it?
Definitely. Definitely. In terms of like your kind of big achievements, I've seen you been on Mock the Week a few times.
It was so weird. It was it was like, I completely believe that like comedy is a lot about luck, and it's about being in the right place at the right time. So I just for years made sure I was in lots of places at lots of different times, and so I was just gigging all the time, as often as I could, always thinking you never know when someone's in the audience, and constantly writing jokes, putting them on Twitter, just in case you never know when someone's going to be there. And my agent, who not the first agent I had, but I then moved to an agency called Avalon about 6 years ago. She messaged me and she said, "Oh, there's the company that make Mock the Week. Their producer was in the audience of a gig you did." And he saw you do a set, and they're trying to pilot this brand new TV show that was very much in like my style of humor anyway. And what they're doing is they're doing these sort of office run throughs of this TV show where it's just like a panel show, but they're just doing it in an office, just behind desks. And they brought me in with about 5 other comedians who were sort of like a similar level of experience. And by this point, I'd like never been on, like, I've been on TV like a couple of times, but on very sort of very small scale things. But I remember going in thinking like, God, these are the guys that make Mock the Week, so I've really got to try and impress them. And I remember just putting in like 2 full days, like properly full days of work on preparing for this office run through in a way that I was probably too much work. I think I just made sure I was going to like, okay, this is absolutely the best I can do. I went through every single tweet I'd ever done in my life, just be like, are there any jokes here that would be relevant that I can sort of slot in? And it was just an office run through where the stars completely aligned and just everything went right. It was perfect. And I remember thinking like, there's the guy that created Mock the Week and Whose Line Is It Anyway. He's literally sat opposite me, and oh my God, that guy's the producer of this show. And I remember thinking like, if I impress him on this, maybe there's a chance they'll get me on Mock the Week, but surely I'd need to be like well known for that to happen. And they liked me on this run through, and then they said, we're going to do another run through next week, would you like to do that? So I did exactly the same, put in so much work. I was on with a different batch of comedians, and then they said, right, we're going to do this pilot properly, like not for TV, but we're going to do it properly in front of an audience at ITV. Do you want to do it? And it was just mind-blowing. It was just to go from, by this point, I was working in comedy professionally and was sort of doing all the clubs and stuff like that. But it just felt like a completely different level. And I'd never known how you get into it. I had no idea how you get chosen, how you get selected, how you get spotted. And it all just seemed like sort of complete luck. But I was like, right, if I can put hard work in the mix there as well, then I can't, it doesn't matter if I don't get it. At least I can walk away with my head held high and go like, I absolutely tried my best. And so we did it in front of ITV, and it was so weird suddenly being with a completely different batch of comedians who were just another level. It was like Milton Jones and Angela Barnes and Tom Allen was hosting, and it was like,
they're really funny.
And it was just so strange.
Really good.
And I remember it going really well in front of ITV. And I remember walking to the Tube afterwards with Angela and Tom, and they were talking about, I think they were going to be on Mock the Week the following week. And they were talking about like a little complaint they had about it, like they had to get up early for it or something like that, but in a jokey way. But obviously so grateful to be on the show, and I sort of jokingly was like, well, you know, come on guys, you can't complain, like you are on Mock the Week. And I remember Tom Allen just saying really matter of factly, he was like, you'll be on it, you'll be on it in a couple of months, 100%. And I remember just thinking, oh, he's just saying that to be polite. And literally about a week later, I'd just come off stage at a truly dreadful gig, and I had like loads and loads of missed calls from my agent. And she just sounded really excited on the phone. She was like, don't get overexcited, but Mock the Week have asked if you would be available potentially to do an episode in September. And it was just mad. It was just so mad. But it's really weird. I always, always imagine, because I was like, that would have, as a comedian, it would have been like my life's ambition. That's what it's all leading up to. So if I managed to achieve that by the age of like 65 and then retired the next day, I'd be happy, because that was like the one thing I sort of wanted to get on. And it was my favorite panel show when I was growing up. And so it was just, it was really weird, but it came with a caveat. Every step came with a caveat. So my agent was like, they've asked if you're available. That might mean they're asking 10 people and they'll choose the best person or the most famous person. So it might not be you. He said, also, these things change. Maybe it's because someone's dropped out, and in a couple of weeks' time, they might suddenly say they're available again. So I was very excited, but I was like, I can't tell anyone. And I was at the pub with my friends after this really bad gig, and they were like, what was the phone call? And I was like, I can't say, just in case it sort of doesn't go ahead. And then like a few days later, it started to look more and more clear. And then eventually my agent like received a contract through the post that she had to sign to say I was definitely sort of going to be on it. But there was still no definitive day where it was like, you're definitely on it. There was no like X Factor judges houses moment where they're like, you're going to be on What the Week. It was always with this caveat of like, if everything goes ahead, it should be fine. And I remember like on the day of the recording, even thinking like, I bet I turn up and they go, I'm really, really sorry, but Frankie Boyle's just decided he'd like to go back on the show. And then they'd kick me off. I was so fully aware that would happen. Yeah. And it was just mad. And I was so scared going into that studio, because it was just on a different, it was just on a different level to anything I'd ever done, because it's filmed in front of I was used to performing in front of like big audiences at comedy clubs and stuff. But Mott the Week not only is filmed in front of a big audience while you're there, but obviously a much, much bigger audience on TV later. And it was really scary knowing that even if you're saying something that gets a laugh in the room, you won't know whether the people of the UK, the viewers of Mott the Week, have enjoyed it until like 3 days later when it actually goes out on TV. And that was weird. The weirdest gap was from the moment filming ended to the moment it actually went out on TV. Because for those 3 days afterwards, it's like if you have an argument with someone and you can't think of a good thing to say. And the moment you walk away from an argument, you're like, oh God, I wish I'd said that. Yeah. That was almost like, it was like on What Week. It was like, you walk away afterwards and you're like, oh, I could have said this. I should have said that. So I was really, really scared going. And the nice thing was that I knew everyone on the lineup, and that made it a lot nicer. I'd met Dara Breen really briefly, because that Edinburgh Fringe, he'd come to see my Edinburgh show. And that was just crazy.
Very, very cool.
It was mad. Honestly, it was mad, because it was just
weird.
He's
really funny. Really, really
funny. Amazing. He's amazing.
Really
funny. And in person is just as funny as when he's on stage. But I remember it just really felt wild when I was still on stage and I just watched him walk into the back of the room where I was doing my Edinburgh show. And it felt weird to know that like, he's bought a ticket and he said to someone, one ticket to Glenmore, please. Probably not in those words, but like, it felt really mad that Dara Breen has said that. And it just felt completely beyond me. And that Edinburgh Fringe, so I did Mott the Week in September, but that August I've been at the Edinburgh Fringe, and I was doing a show that I was so, so proud of. And to this day, I'm so, so proud of, but the audiences just didn't get it. And I think now that I've got audiences who are a bit more sort of like, who know in advance the sort of style I sort of do, the show probably would go down well now. But at the time, it was just going down to not silence every day, but just like mild titters, and then just like, yeah, long periods of just agonizing, just nothingness. And I remember being so, so frustrated. And the first day that I saw like a whole row of people just walk out halfway through, and I really wanted to tell them like, I'm quite good. I've been booked for Mott the Week next month, but obviously I couldn't say that because I couldn't tell. I wasn't allowed to tell anyone. So it filled me with so much courage when I saw Dara Breen walk in, and the audience. Like, I remember watching word get round the audience before the show started, like Dara Breen's here, and that made the show go amazingly, because I think the audience were like, "Well, Dara trusts this guy, so." Yeah, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. He must be good.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It was just the effect.
Just that vote of confidence.
Exactly, of just knowing
he was
sort of there. Yeah. And so that was the one thing that filled me with confidence going into Mott the Week. It was like, right, I've done that. For the rest of my, even if I do badly and I don't even get a single sentence out, I'm just silent for the whole 3 hour recording, I can say for the rest of my life, oh my God, I was on it. And that can never be taken away. That will always have happened.
What was the prep work like for it? Sorry.
The prep work is
did they give you the topics and some
kind
of the words?
Yeah. So you actually they don't tell you in depth, but they'll be like, we'll be talking about the Queen's speech, and we'll be talking about this thing that happened at Downing Street. And then that's all you're given. That is literally all you're given. And it's enough time to be like, have I already got any jokes on this? Right, I can think about these topics, but it isn't long enough to like fully curate. You know, so much of what ends up in the actual edit is still fully improvised in the moment, because you can write your own jokes, but ultimately it is a show where you're chatting to the other people on the panel, and it is a communal thing. And Dara's there holding it all together and throwing to people and saying, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And but that's what made me most scared, because it brought me back to that first improv gig I ever did 10 years ago, where I was like, you're going on stage and you don't necessarily have anything. And unless you say something, this is it. Your career could be completely over. And so I was really, really nervous. And I got there. The nice thing was I'd met everyone on the panel. I'd written for Hugh Dennis on a Radio 4 thing like a few years previously. So I'd met him.
He's my favorite, by the way.
He's amazing. Yeah, I knew him. He was really nice. He was the first person I bumped into in the lobby, and he was really welcoming. I'd met Dara very briefly. There was Angela Barnes, who I'd gigged with several times. She's so lovely. So it was really nice to have her. That felt like very calming. Nish Kumar was on. I'd worked with Nish for like a good couple of years, so that was nice. Kerry Godleman, who I'd met once, and I was like, she won't remember me, but I know she's great and she's lovely and she's hilarious. And then James Acaster, who I'd gigged with like a few times as well. And I remember arriving at my dressing room, feeling really nervous, and Acast was like stood outside my dressing room to basically greet me and welcome me in, and that calmed me down so much, because it was such a nice gesture that he didn't have to do. And we sat down in my dressing room, and he just sort of talked me through it, and he was like, look, sometimes the studio audience don't laugh a great deal, and sometimes they're a bit quiet and weird, because you know, in a freezing cold studio, and it doesn't feel like a normal comedy gig, and they've been having to wait around for 2 hours, that sort of thing. He said, just ignore it, just try and, you know, we'll just try and make each other laugh, and that is what will come out best on TV. And that was 100% the best advice, because it was kind of a sticky audience. And I got the first joke of the show. I was like, I'd heard rumors that maybe the show was a bit of a bear pit, and you're all like competing as much as you can on who's going to say what. And I managed to get the first joke of a recording in, and it got a laugh, and I was like, good, that feels nice. Cause I was so tense that afternoon, because you arrive like 6 hours before you're actually good. Well, not as much as that, but like three or 4 hours before you actually end up going on to do the recording. And those hours are just spent in your dressing room. And so when all you've got to think about is your potential failure and how this could go wrong, it really ends up sort of getting in your head. And then you've got to stand just by the side of a curtain just before the whole show starts. And Dara O'Brien introduces you sort of one by one. This is something you don't see on the TV show, but he comes out at the beginning, chats to the audience, makes them all laugh. And then says a nice thing about everyone. He said a really nice thing about me and brought me on. And it was really nice. It was a nice sort of welcoming audience. But I just had no idea how it would go, and I was just my mouth was so dry, and you have to bring like a selection of outfits to wear, and I've got to make sure if I don't clash and stuff like that. And none of my like first choice what I wanted to wear, not that it matters, but not all the stuff I wanted to wear, they were just like, that's going to clash, that's not going to work. Nish is wearing something similar, that sort of thing. But eventually they gave me a combination of clothes, of my clothes, but a combination I'd never ever worn before. Mm-hmm. And it was like a shirt that already felt a bit tight, and I had to then tuck it into my jeans because they wanted me to wear a jacket, and I was like, oh, I feel really fat. I've never looked like this. This is what I'd normally wear. And that felt really, really weird to already be completely out of your comfort zone and be wearing something you found so uncomfortable as well. My mouth.
But your clothes, right?
But oh yeah, my clothes. But I just never worn them in that combination before. It just felt weird. Yeah. But the recording was so long. But it was about 3 hours, and then we recorded a Christmas episode straight afterwards. But every time you did a joke that got a big laugh, you'd forget it if you then did. You'd forget about that at the moment. You know, if you said a joke that didn't go well, and what all the actor told me, and Angela Barnes told me this as well. She was like, "If you tell a joke that just flops, it doesn't matter. It's not going to make it onto the TV." And everyone's always trying to vie for to get their jokes out as quickly as they can. So if you do one that flops, it doesn't matter. Someone else on the panel will immediately come in with a joke. The audience will laugh and they'll forget. And also, the audience trusts you. They trust that you're there. There's a reason you're there. You're not there because you're rubbish. But I still had that doubt in my mind for the whole 3 hour recording. And by the time it got to the end, I felt like I couldn't hear anything from the audience. And I was like, right, my career ended this evening. And the worst thing is that I get to find out fully in three days' time when it ends up on TV. And I was just sat there thinking, I just don't want this to go out on TV. This has been a complete disaster. I've not humiliated myself. I was like, I'm just going to get forgotten. I'm never going to get booked again on this. I'll never get booked on another show, and I'll just have to concentrate on a different career. We finished the episode, and everyone else in the panel was just so gushing and lovely and really nice about it. And I remember talking to the guy who was at the time Acaster and Nish's agent at the time. He came over to me and he was like really, really happy as well and really excited for me. And everyone was just so delighted. And the staff at Mock the Week as well were like, you'd really, really well, we'll definitely see you back here. And Dara said, we'll see you back here as well. And I was just sat there for ages just like, but you're wrong. I did badly. I said so much stuff that was rubbish and got zero laughs, or I stumbled over my words every time I did have like a decent joke, and that means I won't be able to put it in the edit. And but everyone was like, those bits just get edited out, don't worry about it. And I felt less nervous by the time I actually got to the night of the recording went out, because I was like, I think potentially I've not done a good job, but I've survived this. And I'd been advised by people like, just turn your Twitter notifications off. Just turn off social media, deactivate your account for a couple of days, and then go back on after the episode's gone out. And I was really, really nervous. And then I forgot to do that. And then about 2 minutes into the episode, I'd managed to get a decent amount of sort of screen time. And my phone buzzed, and I checked my phone. I'd had like 5 tweets. It was just all really nice. And it was like, oh my God. And then I started to get really, really hungry for it. And these really nice tweets are coming in. And I was just like, I always think Twitter's a horrible place. So why on earth would I be getting these? And I felt really, really lovely. And about halfway through the episode, someone said, you're shit. And then I felt, oh God, I hate myself. So, you know, and then suddenly I felt rubbish for the rest of the episode. But overall, it just felt incredible. It was just a completely different feeling. And it made me then almost look for a different reaction from audiences. You know, I'd been so used to being so heavily reliant on hearing an audience's reaction in the room every time you're at a comedy club gig. And you know, if the audience aren't laughing, then you're not doing well. And occasionally you get an audience who are just quiet and smiley, but you can't hear that. And so you come off stage being like, that was awful. And I go, no, we enjoyed it. And you're like, you didn't laugh out loud. And they just go, no, we're just quiet laughers. And it still almost doesn't do anything for you. And I realize now with like stuff like panel shows like Mock the Week, it now almost doesn't matter. It sounds awful, but it now doesn't matter the audience in the studio at the time, because what actually matters afterwards, I'm like, no, all I care about now is what happens on Twitter. And I shouldn't care at all. It's, you know, like I should surely have the self-confidence to just ignore any reaction now and just go, no, I've worked hard enough to earn my place on this, and I deserve to be there. But instead I'm like, oh, if one person tweets me saying that I'm crap, then I'm just like, yeah, they're right. I shouldn't have gone to this. It's a silly job. I shouldn't have gone into this job. It's so weird.
It's a mind game, isn't it?
It's such a weird mind game. But I know, yeah, and I know I have the confidence one day to just brush that sort of stuff off. But I know, like, the only step I've taken is I've now muted Twitter notifications from people who don't follow me. So if it's just a complete stranger, but even then occasionally, if I post a tweet and it says you've had 3 replies and I can only see 2 of them, I'm like, oh, what does that third one say? I want to know. I want to know. And it's so pathetic, but that's just how the human mind works. And I know I'm always going to be like that. And I could be on something like Mock the Week forever, but I will always be nervous after every episode. And the thing is, if you have a great, Ed Gamble told me this on one of the episodes, he was like, if you have a terrible, terrible time in the studio, if you do really, really badly in the recording, the edit will come out well. But, you know, the team, the people who make Mock the Week are on your side. They want the show to go out well. So they'll edit it, not like edit in laughter and stuff like that, but they'll just edit in your best bits. So he said, if you have a terrible recording, the edit will turn out well. And if you have an amazing recording, the edit will turn out well. It's always going to be, you know, there's always going to be times sometimes where you're like, you do a joke and you watch it back on the TV and it gets a bit of a laugh and they move on. But you're like, no, it got an applause break in the studio. And you almost end up annoyed that it didn't get the great reaction you sort of thought it would. But I know that the edit's always going to turn out fine and everyone's always going to get a roughly equal amount of screen time and they'll showcase your best jokes. But I think the episode I did most recently was one where the audience were like, a bit quiet, like to the extent where like Dara told them off, not told them off, but like halfway through was like, guys, come on, you know, like you've had like 2 warm-up guys on before the show started, like, you know, this, and the new audience suddenly like warmed up into a bit more. But I remember sat there in that recording thinking like, what if they just broadcast me doing a joke to complete silence on TV when it goes out? And I started to really, really sort of panic. It's silly. And again, I'm talking about this from a position I realize is very privileged indeed, because I'm definitely not complaining about it, because, you know, 2015 me would punch me in the face if he heard me complaining about the fact of like, sometimes I'm not happy about the Twitter reaction. Like I'm so like grateful to be on anything like that. And there have been enough things in my comedy career that I constantly sort of need to remember and cling on to, of like, every time I have a setback, always remember you had this. And that is further ahead than any setback you'll ever have. You know, you're always sort of moving forward. And yes, you occasionally get pushed back, but you'll never be pushed back to a moment where you're back at zero again, because you've always got all the material that you've done over the years that you've tried and tested and you know definitely works. You've always got, you're just collecting it and collecting it and collecting it. Eventually you'll be a has-been. Eventually, all the TV shows you're on will no longer exist, and they will have been off air for 15 years and no one will remember that. And that's going to happen. Of course it will. That's what happens to everyone. But the nice thing about comedy is, and I'd find it harder, and I completely empathize with sports people, because anyone in any sort of sporting profession, you have setbacks which can bring you back to zero. You know, and something like an injury, or eventually your fitness declining with age, is eventually going to bring you back past a point, and you'll never be able to move. And that is something that I'd really have to learn with were I in their shoes. But I'm glad and grateful. If you're creating something, then for the rest of your life, you've always got those things you've created. They will always have existed, and they will always exist. And that's, yeah, that's kind of a pretentious way of looking at it, but it's
the beauty of it, isn't it?
It can be helpful. Yeah, definitely. Exactly.
I just want to ask you just before the end of the conversation about your future plans and your goals now.
I think it's just the first, it's weird. I think the past couple of years, the goal has always been get rebooked for every TV show you've already been on and get on one you've not been on yet. And so obviously like it's so weird. I mean, we'd be having a very different conversation if we were having this conversation a year ago, because as dreadful a situation as COVID-19 has been for the entirety of the population and for a lot of people, you know, a lot worse than others, it's the only sort of shining light I can sort of take from it, and the only sort of silver lining, is that it has completely recalibrated what I care about and what actually is important to me in my career. And I ultimately, once the phrase everyone keeps saying, once all this is over, is that I'm grateful I'll be in a position where I can return to live gigging, and I've still got a radio show I'm doing weekday mornings where I have the opportunity to still be an idiot and tell jokes on air to an audience who, you know, I can't hear, but I can, you know, interact with, you know, online. And I'm really grateful that I can do that, because I know a lot of comics who are having to reassess exactly how they're going to try and get back into this, and unless live gigs return really soon, they're going to have to look elsewhere for work. So at the moment, I've really sort of learned to appreciate everything that sort of happened so far. And the way I see it is just like, right, well, once gigs resume again, if I can get back into live gigging and not take away those gigging opportunities from anyone who sort of needs it more than me, but when possible and when able, I can't wait to get back on the comedy club stage, because that just feels like so long ago now. That, you know, occasionally it almost felt like a burden. If I'd been doing my radio show or like writing work and stuff like that from Monday to Friday, and then you realize, oh God, I'm working Friday night and Saturday night at the clubs as well. You know, you're going to a comedy club on a Saturday night almost with some resentment that you're having to work. But actually now I'm just like, I'd love to be back in that situation again. I can't wait. And it will just, it's difficult to work out the plan of where to actually go, but I think ultimately the aim is always to, because it is a career that's often beset with doubt, the way you can sort of alleviate that is knowing you're getting better and trying to get better. And that's always what I'm trying to do. I never ever want to rest on this, because every year that goes by, I always looking back on the material of the shows I was doing a year ago, and I just think, oh God, that was rubbish. Did I really say that? That was awful. And so there's a determination to get better and better, and it's not in my hands of what's then done with that improvement. That's in the hands of producers and people like that. So all I can do is try and be satisfied that I did enough and I worked hard enough, and that I'm trying to constantly create something new and try and do, you know, try and write comedy that I write jokes in a style that I hope, you know, that no one else is doing, and try and create something fully new. But that's the aim. Because comedy is all about the reaction and what other people think of it. So I can, you know, as long as I do my bit, then it doesn't really matter what people think about it. I mean, if people think it's rubbish, then that might be the case.
But that's really cool, Glenn. Thank you very much for that.
Honestly, Ruben, thanks so much for having me. Honestly, it was a privilege being on this. Thank you.
It was a great story, and just your pathway and the challenges and the growth and kind of the spirit you have to improve. It's a great skill to have, and
thanks a lot. I mean, I know that 99% of the world's population are in a harder position, so it feels weird to talk about it as a struggle, but something with challenges, because you're aware that those challenges as well aren't necessarily important. They're just things that are sort of personal to me. It feels weird to talk about it in terms of challenges and setbacks, but I guess ultimately the only way I've ever managed to get around setbacks is just knowing that in this particular career, there have been times where I've just gone like, I'm just going to give up. I'm going to give up. I'm going to quit. But that's, I've only ever done that really in the dim hope that someone somewhere will go, well, no, don't quit. Sorry. We'll give you your own TV show. I'm really, really sorry. Whereas like, that's not going to happen. No one's ever going to do it for you. So like, I've always known it. If I gave up, I would be forgotten immediately, just completely. So like, that the thing that sort of spurred me on is just like, well, you know, it's a sort of self-determination, I guess, of you've got to keep doing this for yourself, because ultimately no one else will, because why should they? Everyone's got their own lives to worry about.
Exactly. Definitely. Great. Thank you very much, Glenn.
It's been a joy. It's been an absolute joy. Lovely to catch up with you again. It's been,
you too as well,
many a year.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Underdog Way podcast. Please subscribe, leave a comment, and look out for more awesome and inspiring conversations.